Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during this workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Carolina. I, too, would like to welcome everyone today to the Cancer Care and Lymphoma Research Foundation workshop, Update on Lymphoma from the 2011 American Society of Hematology ASH Annual Meeting. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and we have a number of other organizations that have also collaborated with us to make this program possible. And we have on the call today over 1,377 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, and we have international participants from Argentina, Australia, Canada, China, Kenya, Korea, Mexico, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Syria, West Africa, and United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a great honor to have all of you on the call today. It's an amazing this global call. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care, and those materials is information about all of our collaborating organizations. There's information about our speakers and the topics that will be covered, and there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer going, you know, going forward into next year? Indeed, we're planning the programs for 2012, and this particular program has been a featured program that we've done annually, and so any of the topics that you are interested in our offering, please tell us, and we'll try very hard to offer them. This particular workshop today is one that many of you have requested that we do over the many years that we've been collaborating with the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Now, over 15 years, we've been collaborating together on these. Now, I'd like to acknowledge that today's program was supported through grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Genentech Biooncology, Biogen IDEC, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, and Seattle Genetics. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program, this really collaborative industry support to the Lymphoma Research Foundation for this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology. He's Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, Clinical Director, New York Cornell Center for Lymphoma and Myeloma. He's also Chief Lymphoma Myeloma Service and Associate Director for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Cancer Center. He is a very often featured speaker on our programs, and Dr. Leonard is going to address an overview of lymphoma. He's going to present disease-specific treatment updates to indolent and follicular lymphoma, current treatment options and new research presented at ASH, and clinical trials. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Leonard.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you to all of you for joining in today. I'd also like to thank Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation for your support and all you do for patients, as well as for bringing this program to our audience. And I like to tell patients that the landscape, the treatments, the prognoses over time for patients with lymphoma is really quickly changing and improving in many, many different situations, and so there is reason for lots of optimism for patients, and one of the reasons is because there is a great deal of research going on, much of it clinical research, and Dr. Vose and I look forward to the meetings that we go to every year where we either present research we're doing or hear about research other people are doing, and sometimes that research which comes forward ultimately affects patients and how we go back home and treat our patients. And so the American Society of Hematology meeting, which was held basically last weekend, is one of the key lymphoma meetings in the world where many of the most important studies are presented. And so it's always nice to come back and give you information about what's new and going on, both that we hope will help our patients and how we go forward in treating patients. So I'm going to start, as Carolyn mentioned, with just a couple minutes on lymphoma in general, an overview. I know that's something that's familiar to many of you, but for some of you who are less familiar, just to remind the group that Lymphoma is the most common of the blood cancers. It typically presents itself in the lymph nodes, the glands in the neck, abdomen, pelvis, in the groin region, under the arms, but really can affect any organ of the body. And the crucial thing in lymphoma is not so much the stage, meaning where it spread, but generally speaking, it's which type of lymphoma that the patient is dealing with. The immune cells are kind of like the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, Marines that do different jobs for the immune system, and they have switches that regulate their growth, and when those switches get broken, one gets a lymphoma. And because there are many types of immune cells, there are many types of lymphoma. There are over 60 types of lymphoma. So a crucial thing for a patient diagnosed with lymphoma is to know which of the 60 types of lymphoma one is dealing with. Lymphomas are divided into Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Dr. Vose will talk a little bit more about that and what's new there a little bit later. But most patients with lymphoma have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Most of those non-Hodgkin's lymphomas are what we call B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. About 90% or so are B-cell. About 10% or so are T-cell lymphomas. And when we think of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, or in fact the Hodgkin's lymphomas, I tend to think of them in kind of three big categories, one being what are termed indolent or slow-growing lymphomas. And those are lymphomas that respond well to treatment but tend to be chronic lymphomas that people live with for many years, although in some people they can be more challenging. For many people, it's something that's chronically managed over a long period of time. The second big category is called aggressive lymphomas, and those are lymphomas that for some people can be very difficult, but for many people can go through a course of treatment, and it goes away, goes into remission, and is essentially what we would term cured, meaning it doesn't tend to come back. And then there's a third group of lymphomas that I would term the other group of lymphomas. And those are special in their prognosis and their treatment, some of which are treated chronically like the indolent lymphomas, some of which are treated more aggressively and can be eliminated from the body with treatment like the aggressive lymphomas. But really those are the three kind of big buckets of lymphoma. And generally speaking, it's important to know what type of lymphoma one is dealing with, and then if one is dealing with one of the lymphomas that the treatment can get rid of it, obviously one would like to do that and pick a treatment that can eradicate the disease and get rid of it. That's, again, more common in many of the aggressive lymphoma types, whereas in the indolent, and Hodgkin's lymphoma would also fit into that category, generally speaking. The more indolent lymphoma types, or slower-growing types of lymphoma, again, are typically more chronically managed. They tend to respond to the treatment, but they tend to be something that comes back over time. But many people can live for decades or even longer with the disease, although for some people it's a problem. So Dr. Vose is going to come back to the aggressive lymphomas a little bit more later in her section. I'm going to spend the rest of my time focusing on the indolent lymphomas. And indolent lymphomas include most commonly what's termed follicular lymphoma. That's the most common of the indolent lymphomas. There are also other types of indolent lymphomas. Some of the names include lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma or Waldenstrom's, macroglobulinemia. The names get to be a little bit long and complicated. It also includes small lymphocytic lymphoma or chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or marginal zone lymphoma. Those are, typically speaking, most of the indolent lymphomas that we deal with. And so in indolent lymphomas, the big questions that come up for a patient when they're diagnosed and when they undergo what's called staging to see where the lymphoma is, the big questions tend to be, do I need treatment right now? And then what is the best treatment? And so to take those questions as they come, really the issue with indolent lymphomas is that if patients feel fine with an indolent lymphoma, there has generally been very little evidence, and in fact several studies that supported the idea, that in fact if a patient feels well with indolent lymphoma, that early treatment or immediate treatment doesn't necessarily need to be happening. In other words, watching and waiting can be a reasonable thing to do. And obviously, treatment decisions are individualized, but for many patients, watching and waiting is an appropriate treatment option or management option, because if it's a lymphoma that is not bothering you, that is hard to get rid of, and that is doesn't necessarily make you live longer by rushing to treat it versus waiting and treating it later when it starts to cause problems, then many people feel that observation rather than immediate treatment is perfectly reasonable. And so that's an option for many patients. And there have been studies in the past that have suggested that, in fact, when you look 10, 20, 30 years later, that rushing to treat an indolent lymphoma for many people doesn't necessarily improve how they do in the long term, meaning are they alive decades and decades later. And so there are that's question one. Question two really comes up to be, well, okay, if I'm a patient with indolent lymphoma and it's gotten to the point that I need treatment, what is the best treatment for me? And to be quite honest, there's a lot of debate as to what is the best treatment. And for certain situations, doctors feel that treatment A is better than treatment B. But in the big picture, there are lots of different options for patients. And what is the best option remains to be seen. And so I want to focus, I'm going to talk really about three parts of things and what's new from the hematology meetings in a couple of different areas. The first is, what about that patient who is getting to a point and has made the decision with their doctor and decided to need that they are going to get treatment, and they're getting treatment, but they've chosen a less aggressive treatment approach, meaning historically, patients were treated with very different chemotherapy regimens, a regimen called chlorambucil, a regimen called CVP, a regimen called CHOP. These are things, in particular CHOP, that many people on the line may have heard of, because it's a commonly used regimen in lymphoma. There, about 15 years ago, a drug called rituximab, or Rituxan, came on the scene, and this is a monoclonal antibody that it works through a variety of different mechanisms. It's an immune protein injected into the blood that activates the immune system to fight the lymphoma and also flicks switches on the lymphoma cells to make the cells die off and to make the chemotherapy work better. And so rituximab makes chemotherapy work better in many, many different situations. It's also relatively easier to tolerate than most chemotherapy drugs. People can get fever, chills, shakes, a little bit of a reaction to it, but infections, hair loss, and some of the other side effects are less with rituximab. And so the question has come up, can patients get rituximab by itself as an initial treatment? And for some patients, that's a very reasonable treatment. And so the study that was presented at ASH, I think probably one of the few most important studies presented at the hematology meetings, relates to a study called the RESORT study. And this was a study that took patients with follicular lymphoma getting their first treatment and said, okay, these are patients that have low tumor burden, meaning they don't have very, very big lymph nodes, but they had enough that the patient and the doctor decided to get treatment. And the patients all received 4 doses of rituximab without chemotherapy. And then once those patients responded to the treatment, they were randomly assigned to continuing on maintenance rituximab, 1 dose every 3 months, versus observation, no more treatment after the initial 4 doses, but then when the disease came back at some point in the future, giving rituximab again for 4 doses. So many people on the line are familiar with the concept of maintenance therapy with rituximab, continuing the patient on rituximab if it's working kind of for years to keep them in remission longer by giving 1 dose every few months. So this study said, well, gee, if we know that we can give patients Rituxan again when their disease comes back, maybe we don't have to keep people on maintenance. Maybe we can just retreat them. So it randomized this group of patients to maintenance rituximab versus retreatment without maintenance, but getting the rituximab again when the disease came back. And so the important point of this study, and I think it's a very important study, is that it didn't matter as far as the mileage that the patients got out of rituximab, that basically when you look at things, about 3.5 years to 4 years later was the mileage that this group of patients got out of rituximab. And it didn't matter whether they continued on the maintenance or whether they just did the 4 doses and stopped and then did rituximab again when they needed it. And the advantage of this, for some people, might argue that you could give a lot less rituximab. In fact, on average, the patients who had the retreatment had many fewer doses of rituximab versus those that were getting the maintenance continually throughout the entire period of time. There was no difference in overall survival. Both groups did very, very well. Most patients were doing very, very well. But the mileage that they got out of rituximab was the same. And so the conclusions of the authors basically was that in this group of patients who had had no previous treatment, they had follicular lymphoma, that maintenance rituximab versus just four doses of rituximab and then retreatment when they needed was essentially the same. Both groups of patients did very well, and the cost was actually one-third less of the rituximab, meaning the people that got the retreatment only needed one-third the number of doses. There was no change in quality of life or anxiety, and so basically either way was fine. So I think the message here questions how important it is for patients getting maintenance rituximab, because you can, in this situation and perhaps other situations, we don't know yet, that getting the four doses of maintenance and then not getting the four doses of treatment and then not doing maintenance may be a very reasonable way to go, because then you can do retreatment at some point in the future. So I'll leave this study at this point. I would suspect that there may be questions on this later, and which we'll come back to, because this is an important issue for many patients getting treatment with follicular lymphoma. Now, the other big study that I want to mention was a study that we've all been waiting for, and Dr. Vose and I have worked in this area for several years. This was a big national trial that took patients who also had untreated follicular lymphoma that needed treatment and randomly assigned them to CHOP chemotherapy plus rituximab, again, one of the standard regimens, versus CHOP chemotherapy without rituximab, but instead followed by iodine-131 tocilizumab, also noted as called Bexxar. So this essentially said, if we give CHOP and rituximab, how does that compare to CHOP followed by radioimmunotherapy with Bexxar as initial treatment for patients with follicular lymphoma? So this was a very important study done across the country. It involved over 500 patients. And the bottom line of this study was that the outcomes were very similar, that patients did the same whether or not they had one dose of the radioimmunotherapy after CHOP without rituximab, or whether they had the CHOP plus rituximab. And so in some ways we're a little bit disappointed, because we'd like one group to do better, because that tells us that we're making progress. On the other hand, it tells you that either way seems pretty reasonable. And I think what we're left with, and I think one of the important findings and conclusions of this, was that while there were no differences between the two approaches, that progression-free, meaning how long patients stay in remission, and overall survival, meaning how long people were alive, was outstanding. People did very, very well with this group of patients. And in fact, most of the patients were still in remission at the time of the analysis a few years later. And so this will continue to be studied. There will be studies that combine rituximab with radioimmunotherapy. There were several other studies at the meeting that were non-comparison studies looking at this. But at this point, I think the jury is still out whether or not it is better to give rituximab with chemotherapy or the chemotherapy with the radioactive antibody. But both groups here did very well. And I think there is reason for optimism that these regimens are good building blocks to move in the future. I'm just going to take one more minute, and I know we'll come back to some of these issues, but I also just want to leave you with a couple of thoughts about new drugs and clinical trials. And it's very important for patients to think about clinical trials when they're dealing with their doctors and thinking about treatments, because clinical trials represent a new option where everything Dr. Vose and I are telling you today really comes from, because patients participated in clinical trials. And anytime you go to your doctor and talk about treatment, that's because the doctors are analyzing data from clinical trials. And so participating in clinical studies helps us all to figure out what the best treatments are. It also makes available to you new drugs that are available and in clinical studies that may ultimately help patients. And there were several studies at the hematology meetings that I think are important for patients with follicular and other indolent lymphomas to keep in mind. Dr. Vose will mention some of those for the aggressive types. One of those is a type of new versions of rituximab. One of those is called GA101. Another one of those is called ofatumumab. Those are drugs that are being studied in various different lymphoma settings. And the bottom line is that there are reasons to think they might be better than rituximab. We don't know that they are. There are studies looking at that. But those are new, important new studies going on because we're hoping to further improve the benefits that patients can achieve with rituximab by giving new second and third generation versions. And then I also want to mention that there is another drug called lenalidomide, which is a cousin of thalidomide. It's a pill that has numerous effects on lymphoma cells, and it was looked at in various different clinical trials. It's an FDA-approved drug for other diseases, for multiple myeloma, and it is being combined with rituximab. It's being combined with other medications, and Dr. Vose has participated, as have I, in some of the clinical trials with that drug. That's a very important category of drugs, I think, for patients with indolent lymphoma. And then finally, we have a couple of other drugs called kinase inhibitors. These are drugs that affect the switches that regulate growth of cells. One of those is called Cal-101. Another one of those has the initials that start with PCI-32765. These are two drugs that are pills that are what are called kinase inhibitors that affect the switches on the cells and the growth of the cells, and those are very interesting. And I'll leave it at that because these are not only important for the indolent lymphomas, but Dr. Vose may come back to them with the aggressive lymphomas. So with that, I will stop and turn it over to Dr. Vose.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Leonard, for an outstanding and very, very informative presentation. Lots of information for everybody. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Vose, and Dr. Vose is the Newman M. and Mildred E. Harris Professor. She's Chief Division of Hematology Oncology, Professor of Medicine, Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Vose is going to talk about disease-specific treatment updates for aggressive lymphoma, including Hodgkin, mantle cell, and diffuse large B-cell. Current treatment options and new research presented at ASH, clinical trials, and doctor-patient communication. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Vose.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and I want to also thank Cancer Care and Lymphoma Research Foundation for sponsoring this great opportunity for patients. So first I'm going to talk in general about some of the issues that John spoke about and specifically get into some treatment options and new updates for patients with some different subtypes of lymphoma. So Dr. Leonard went over, in general, the differences between non-Hodgkin's and Hodgkin's disease. And, of course, I think the important aspect is that there's 85 different types of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and there's many different types of Hodgkin's disease as well, probably 8 or 10 types. And so it's very important to know exactly what type of lymphoma you have when dealing with this. You should know that because you want to be able to get information about what type of lymphoma you have, what the treatment options are when you're researching that as well. And so it's very important to know that different treatment options are correct for different patients and different types of lymphomas and different stages of lymphoma, so make sure that you know your own information. Today I'm going to give some updates of some of the abstracts that were presented in the American Society of Hematology, and first I'm going to go over the area of Hodgkin's lymphoma. And Hodgkin's lymphoma is a type of lymphoma that typically we see in younger patients. It can have an average age perhaps of about 25, and then in middle age, in 40s, patients that are 40 and 50, we don't see that very often, and then it can go up again in older patients. So the treatment options for patients that are younger versus older patients are a bit different, and also with the different types of Hodgkin's lymphoma. A couple of important abstracts that were presented at the American Society of Hematology. There was a very important abstract that was a long-term follow-up of a clinical trial that was done in Canada through the National Cancer Institute in Canada Clinical Trials Group. And this is a final analysis of a clinical trial that was done several years ago. For patients with Hodgkin's disease, we do need to have very long follow-up to see what the outcomes of our treatments are. In this particular trial, this was for patients that had very localized Hodgkin's, so patients that just had non-bulky, so small masses, stage 1 or 2, which means just one or two locations that was on the same side of the body. And then patients were looked at either as low or high-risk patients. For the patients that were low-risk patients, they were looked at and randomized to receive either chemotherapy alone with ABVD, which is a standard chemotherapy that we use, or they were looked at and combined some chemotherapy plus radiation therapy. This study has been looked at previously and had some short-term follow-up that looked about the same in both of those arms of the trial. But with this follow-up, actually the median follow-up for these patients was now in excess of 11 years, so very good follow-up on these treatment options for patients. And what we saw was that with a short-term follow-up, the two arms appeared to be pretty equivalent. But with longer follow-up, there was a little bit of concern that perhaps the patients that received the radiation in addition to chemotherapy were having some additional problems with other side effects from the radiation long-term, either secondary complications and damage to their lungs or heart, or in some cases, some incidences of second cancers or malignancies. So with longer-term follow-up, it appeared, at least in this study, that patients receiving chemotherapy alone for localized Hodgkin's had a better outcome. Although one does have to say that this particular study used radiation therapy that would be more extensive, perhaps, than what we use nowadays. And that was a very important follow-up, and that was in a large number of patients, so important study that was presented at ASH this year. Another study for Hodgkin's lymphoma that I want to discuss was a study where they looked at what happened after the treatment for patients and looking at either CT scans or PET scans, which are a different type of scan that we often use more recently to evaluate patients with lymphoma. So it's been known for quite a number of years that if a patient's CT and PET scan were completely normal or negative after the treatment for their lymphoma, in this case Hodgkin's lymphoma, they had an excellent chance of staying in remission. What happens sometimes is that patients that have a residual mass on the CAT scan can have a PET scan that's completely normal or negative. And in that case, it's always been a little bit controversial. Does that patient do differently or better or worse than patients that have a completely negative scan on both scans? This particular study looked at a number of different patients and looked at their results after treatment for Hodgkin's disease and looked at the CAT scan with respect to the mass that was left behind and then whether the PET scan was positive or negative. And what this study showed that was different than previous studies was that patients that had a little bit larger masses on the CAT scan after the treatment, 4 centimeters or more, but had a PET scan that was negative, perhaps did not do quite as well as patients that had both negative CT and PET scan. So this is the first study that really showed that. This is something that we're certainly going to be following up with additional studies as well. Another important abstract I'd like to talk about from the ASH meeting was an abstract that many of us participated in looking at the outcomes of pregnancy during lymphoma. And most of these patients did have Hodgkin's lymphoma, although there were some that also had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and were treated for that. This particular study was presented by Dr. Evans, and he looked at 88 patients that had been diagnosed with lymphoma and became pregnant or were pregnant at the time of diagnosis, and looked at the outcome for the patients as well as the outcome for the children after that. And I think that the upshot of this particular evaluation showed that patients that are pregnant can be treated very successfully for many types of lymphomas, either Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's, and that in most cases, the patients themselves, with respect to the outcome for the lymphoma, was excellent, and also in most cases, the outcome of the pregnancy was also excellent. So I think this can give us some important information about how to successfully treat our patients with lymphoma that are pregnant or become pregnant, and that we can treat those patients successfully. I'd also like to turn my attention now to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And that's an aggressive type of lymphoma. That's the most common type that we see in adult patients, and it's one that's the most common in the United States as well. That type of lymphoma typically grows fairly quickly and does need to be treated with aggressive chemotherapy. It's also a type of lymphoma that's able to be cured with chemotherapy in many circumstances, so one that we obviously want to catch right away and to be treated successfully. So it's always been pretty straightforward as far as what we do up front for the first treatment for those patients. As far as how we can predict how patients do and what happens at the time of relapse is a little bit less certain. So I want to talk about a couple of different studies that were presented at the American Society of Hematology trying to look at those aspects. one study looked at some different analysis of different genes in the lymphoma itself and tried to quantify and see if we can try to predict how patients are going to do with treatment outcomes. There was a very important study that was looked at using some specimens from a previous clinical trial looking at patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who received R-CHOP chemotherapy, which is a standard of care for that type of lymphoma. And they looked at materials from those patients, and we had outcome knowledge for those patients, so we know what happened to them, and looked at different genes in their original lymph node biopsy. And what was found was that there are a number of genes that we can try to look for that are successful in trying to help us predict outcome for patients, even in addition to the clinical predictors that we look at with respect to extent of lymphoma, some of the other information such as age or other lab tests we look at. These genetic properties can also help us try to predict how patients are going to do. And I think that's also an interesting part for the way of the future to try to see if we can choose different therapies for different patients based upon this genetic analysis. That's not something that's currently in clinical practice, but something that we're looking at in clinical trials and also trying to look toward the future to try to specifically choose different treatments for different patients. Another clinical trial that I want to talk about that was presented at the ASH meeting was actually a presentation that I did, and that is a large clinical trial that was for patients with relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So they already had their initial therapy, and at the time the lymphoma returned, the standard of care treatment would be an autologous stem cell transplant for younger patients. So we've always tried to look at new options and treatments for our patients with this diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. This clinical trial randomized patients to a standard autologous stem cell transplant where we use high doses of chemotherapy and then use the patient's own stem cells from their blood to make sure that they recover from that. They were randomized to either a standard transplant or a stem cell transplant adding a radioimmunotherapy, so an antibody that has radiation attached to it as part of the treatment option. This trial was performed over the last several years, and now there was at least a two-year follow-up for all the patients on this study. It was seen in prior studies that the addition of this radioimmunotherapy might have a better outcome for patients, and then we wanted to do a randomized study. The outcome for the patients, however, in this trial showed that there was no difference in the outcome with respect to overall survival or failure-free survival, that is the lymphoma in complete remission and alive and disease-free after the transplant, with the addition of the additional radioimmunotherapy. So they were equivalent outcomes, no additional side effects or toxicity in the same outcome. So that is probably not going to be an addition necessarily that we'll be seeing that much of in the future for transplantation. As far as relapse disease, there's also, as Dr. Leonard mentioned, a lot of new exciting drugs that are in clinical trials that are being looked at specifically. A lot of these new drugs are looking at different pathways in the lymphoma cells and trying to see if we can use medications that specifically target these pathways without trying to cause side effects to the normal tissues or organs for patients. Chemotherapy, as we know, standard chemotherapy affects all rapidly dividing cells, and that causes a lot of the side effects that patients have, such as hair loss, mouth sores, nausea. But a lot of the newer medicines we're studying in clinical trials actually try to target these specific pathways in the lymphoma cells and leave the normal cells alone. Probably some of the interesting ones that were presented at the ASH meeting that we're looking at try to target the B-cell pathway. And there's a number of different agents, as Dr. Leonard mentioned, in that pathway. A couple of them were presented at the ASH meeting. One exciting one that I think we're going to be hearing about more in the future is called the Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor, a BTK inhibitor. And the number for that is PCI-32765. So it's a new medicine, something that we're studying for a number of different types of lymphomas. There's been information that's presented at the ASH meeting that this particular agent may target specific types of lymphomas. Specifically for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, it appears that it may target what's called the activated B-cell subtype of lymphoma. So this just gives us some idea that perhaps for the future we can try to target this to these particular patients that have this subtype of lymphoma and may be more helpful than patients with other types of lymphomas. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma is a different type of lymphoma that's only been fairly recently evaluated as a separate type of lymphoma, but now we know that there's a wide spectrum. Some patients with mantle cell lymphoma have the type that grows very slowly. Some patients have the type that grow more aggressively or in a faster fashion. It's always been a little bit controversial what type of treatment is the best for these patients. There was a large study that was presented at the ASH meeting where patients from Europe were randomized to receive either R-CHOP chemotherapy, the standard type we use for other aggressive lymphomas, or a rituximab plus fludarabine and cyclophosphamide regimen. The patients also had a second randomization to maintenance rituximab versus interferon. This was for patients that were a little bit older with mantle cell lymphoma. Basically, the upshot of this trial was that the patients that received the R-CHOP, rituximab plus CHOP chemotherapy, appeared to have a little bit better outcome than the patients that had the fludarabine-based regimen. In addition, this is one of the first studies that showed that rituximab maintenance after treatment for mantle cell lymphoma did appear to have a little bit better outcome as well, and that interferon maintenance was perhaps not the best option for these patients. So this is a good first step in trying to modify our treatment for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. There was also a couple of other abstracts I want to talk about for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. So after the patient has received their first treatment and then the lymphoma comes back, looking at different options. There was, again, an abstract that looked at the PCI-32765 molecule. That's a pill that targets this Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It has been combined with rituximab and some other agents to look at the possibility of treating mantle cell lymphoma. There was a clinical trial that was presented at ASH with 68 patients with mantle cell lymphoma where this was used as a single agent, and they had almost a 70% response rate, that is the shrinking of the tumor for these patients. And so this looks very promising in this type of lymphoma as well. There was also one other type of clinical trial that I think was interesting on mantle cell lymphoma, combining a older agent called cladribine, which is given in the vein, with a newer agent called vorinostat. And that also was combined with rituximab as well. This treatment was just a phase one treatment. That means trying to see different combinations and doses of these regimens, but also appeared to be quite promising in these patients with mantle cell lymphoma. I think for the future, as far as what we're going to see from these and other studies, are that we're trying to specifically hone down and use treatments for patients with different types of lymphomas and to be able to modify that based upon a lot of our studies and genetic information that we're learning from clinical trials and from samples. As far as the future treatment options and looking toward the future for new research, I think the things that we want to talk about would specifically be trying to make sure that, again, you know your type of lymphoma, what your options are, that you do have perhaps several different considerations for treatment, and to be able to take that time to look around and look for options, I think is always a good idea, and to be able to be knowledgeable about your specific type of lymphoma, to understand that there are options out there, to know your resources such as the Lymphoma Research Foundation, Cancer Care, and other areas to look for different options and support. I think I'll turn it over back to Carolyn at this point.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Vose, for also a very informative, very excellent presentation, lots of excellent information, and also just covering a lot of different points that I think people struggle with, and you kind of gave some very helpful hints to everybody. So thank you. I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Brian Tomlinson, and Brian is the Chief Program Officer for the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And Brian, actually, I would say, has really been the architect of this program today, of many of the programs that we partner with the Lymphoma Research Foundation. We've been partnering together for the past 15 years, and I have to say that in working with Brian, he's really been instrumental in accessing support for the programs as well as speakers and topics. So I really want to thank Brian for his extremely important role in making these programs possible. And Brian is going to talk over with you the free support services and programs provided by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. I now turn the program over to Brian.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you for that very gracious introduction, and again for the wonderful partnership with you and your team over the years on presenting these calls. I'd also like to thank our esteemed faculty, Drs. Leonard and Bose. These two individuals spend countless hours and dedicate countless hours of their time to helping the Lymphoma Research Foundation with all of our programs and services, as well as serving on our scientific advisory board. So we really do thank you for joining us today. And I would like to acknowledge Genentech, Millennium, and Seattle Genetics for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization, and we're devoted exclusively to funding innovative research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with information about the disease. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and to assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. To date, the organization has awarded close to $50 million in research, and more than 40,000 people access our programs each year. The LRF provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for all of you on the phone and for all people dealing with a lymphoma diagnosis, including our lymphoma helpline, where our professional public and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information about the disease as well as appropriate resources. You heard Drs. Leonard and Bose talk earlier a lot about clinical trials. We have a clinical trials information service where a member of our helpline team can assist you in your search for information about clinical trials and identifying appropriate trials for you. A Lymphoma Support Network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. A variety of print and online publications and newsletters, including 4 comprehensive disease guides, over 20 disease-specific fact sheets, and informational e-newsletters. We have a variety of webcasts and podcasts that are available on our website that talk about specific types of the disease, treatment options, and psychosocial support topics. The organization offers a variety of educational conferences on the national, regional, and local levels. This past October, the organization released 4 new disease-specific websites that focus on follicular lymphoma, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, mantle cell lymphoma, and peripheral T-cell lymphoma. We're also in the process of developing 2 new websites for Hodgkin lymphoma and anaplastic large cell lymphoma. For more information, please contact a member of our helpline by calling us at 800-500-9976 or visiting our website, lymphoma.org. Again, thank you to Carolyn, our speakers, and the supporters of today's call. Carolyn?
Well, thank you very much, Brian. Just wonderful to let everyone know about the resources of the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Many of you have already accessed those, but if you haven't, please do take advantage of them. Well, now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Carolina to bring all of our speakers on board, and let's try to take as many questions as possible. Carolina?
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question at this time, please press star then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press star then 1. And we have a question from the line of Ron R. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to ask a question as to whether there have been any additional advances for testing to see whether a patient with indolent lymphoma will stay in remission so long as so that the word cure could actually be thought of, or whether it's likely that it's going to come back in the near future. Has such a test any advances on that sort of thing?
Thank you, Ron. That's an excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Leonard to address that question.
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's a hard question to totally answer. It's a hard question for patients totally to deal with. The reason being that indolent lymphomas can come back many, many years later, and so we can do studies that suggest that people are living longer, but to get to the point that we can say that X percent of people are never going to have the disease come back and therefore are cured is a little bit more challenging because, one, you know, there are examples of patients who have been in remission 20 years and you'd say maybe they're cured and then year 21 the disease comes back. And so it's really a long-term prospect. Now, on the other hand, some people might argue that the term cure is really a relative cure, and if you live a normal lifespan, have a normal quality of life, whether or not you have lymphoma, if your lymphoma is behaving itself and allows you to have a normal quality quality of life and die with the lymphoma at a ripe old age rather than from the lymphoma, that whether or not it's a cure, whether or not you're cured is kind of irrelevant. So there's a lot of philosophy there. I think that it's going to be hard to say that that we've cured follicular lymphoma even when we have, because it will take us many years to show that that's actually happened. But I am optimistic that people are living longer and doing better with follicular lymphoma, and I have no doubt that for many patients, ultimately their follicular lymphoma is what I would call effectively cured, where they could live a normal life and basically have this almost like a hitchhiker rather than something that limits their disease. Unfortunately, there's work to be done to get to that point, and for too many people, things don't go quite as well as we'd like, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
Excellent. Thank
you. Can I just say one other thing, too?
Yes, please,
I just wanted to say it. A lot of times what I tell patients with this type of issue is that you need to think of it more like we're treating high blood pressure or diabetes, that we can't get rid of the underlying disease, but perhaps we can control it with our medications, and that's kind of a lot of the research that we're doing as well.
Excellent. Excellent point. Thank you. Our next question, Carolina.
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Raphael S. Please go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Leonard, you briefly mentioned the Revlimid and Rituxan combination. Could you talk a little bit more about when patients might want to consider that regimen? And also, I've heard that there are some trials looking at Revlimid as maintenance, if you could address that as well.
Thank you.
Sure. So,
Dr. Leonard?
Sure. So Revlimid, again, also known as lenalidomide, is a cousin of an older drug called thalidomide. It's a pill. It has numerous effects on lymphoma cells. It can turn on the immune system to fight the lymphoma. It can affect the blood vessels. It can have effects directly on the lymphoma cells. This is a pill. It's FDA approved for multiple myeloma and for certain other blood disorders. It's not FDA approved for lymphoma, but it has been looked at in different clinical trials, and in basically every type of lymphoma it's been studied in, whether that be follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, large cell or other aggressive lymphomas, as well as chronic lymphocytic leukemia, it can shrink the disease a percentage of the time, depending on the study and the situation, about 20 to 25% of the time up to about 40% of the time. And in some people, it can be durable, meaning the shrinkage or the disease control lasts a long period of time, and there have been many different combinations of that drug with Rituxan or Rituximab, with chemotherapy. There are studies looking at R-CHOP, for instance, with lenalidomide, and then there are different strategies to use it as part of a maintenance treatment. So right now, and there are clinical trials using lenalidomide and rituximab as initial treatment in mantle cell lymphoma. That's something we're doing right now at Cornell to delay chemotherapy in those patients. There are trials looking at it in follicular lymphoma, and there are trials looking at it as initial treatment, and there are trials looking at it in aggressive large cell lymphoma. So it's not a standard treatment. It's mostly being looked at in clinical trials at this point in time. I think it's a very, very promising regimen. We don't know if it is better than our other treatments or how best to incorporate it into our other treatment regimens. That's what those studies are doing right now.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Donald M. Please go ahead.
Yes. In the case of mantle cell lymphoma, one of the treatments is bendamustine or Treanda plus Rituxan. And I'd like to know if this has been approved, and also the side effects of the Treanda in the veins and some of the things to watch out for.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So in mantle cell lymphoma, there was a very large study that looked at R-CHOP, more standard treatment for aggressive lymphoma, versus R-bendamustine or Treanda. And this study was done in Europe. It showed in mantle cell lymphoma that certainly the outcome with the Treanda plus rituximab was just as good as the R-CHOP and perhaps even a little bit better, with a little bit decreased side effects. So decrease in the hair loss, a decrease in the low blood counts and infections in some degree. It typically is paid for mantle cell lymphoma in most cases, although that would have to be checked in each individual case. and is a very effective treatment for patients with mantle cell.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question?
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Malcolm L. Please go ahead.
Hi. I was diagnosed in 1998 with low-grade non-Hodgkin's, which transformed in June of 2009, or part of it transformed to B-cell. I guess it was diagnosis 3A. I went through the standard R-CHOP successfully. I went through the maintenance program of Rituxan for 2 years. During that time, I was at MD Anderson.
And your question?
Yes, the question is, the doctor says on average it will return in 80 to 82 months. Some form of that low grade will transform again. Is that accurate? In other words, could I expect that will happen? I mean, you've been positive in terms of how to handle it. Should it happen again?
Okay. That's an excellent question. Dr. Lennon, could you address that?
So the concept of what is a transform lymphoma is one that comes up for people with indolent lymphoma sometimes, meaning that there are the most common scenario is a patient has indolent lymphoma, whether that be follicular type or other types, and then at some point the lymphoma changes. The switches that regulate the growth of the cell changes, and that indolent, slow-growing lymphoma turns into a more aggressive lymphoma. That's why sometimes we do PET scans and sometimes we do biopsies on patients that have had follicular lymphoma, because in certain situations we're suspicious that it is transformed or changed, and we need to do a biopsy to see if that has happened, because the treatment tends to be more aggressive. We tend to use R-CHOP if the patient hasn't had chemotherapy before, and then sometimes we follow that up even with stronger, more aggressive treatment. Again, all of this depends on the individual situation, because there are other scenarios where we don't need to do that. So because patients can get to a transformed lymphoma through very different ways, meaning sometimes it happens at the time of diagnosis, sometimes it happens many years later, sometimes it happens having had no prior treatment, sometimes after having many prior treatments, it's hard to generalize. There are some people where a transformation means that the disease is going to get harder to treat and we need to treat it more aggressively. And there are other people where they've not had much treatment and the disease behaves itself and it goes back to being an indolent lymphoma that just kind of putters along. So it's hard to generalize, and I would say the statistics are hard to really say what to expect, because it's a very individualized situation as to kind of how the patient got there and where their situation is. I think it's important to remember that this can happen and doctors should consider it, and biopsies may need to be done in patients with indolent lymphoma when the disease is coming back in certain situations, and then what to do with it is a very individualized sort of decision.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Tony G. Please go ahead.
Yeah, this is a question for either Dr. Leonard or Dr. Volz. From your takeaway from ASH, what interested you the most for possible treatments for follicular lymphomas?
Dr. Leonard, would you want to start with that?
Well, I think from the standpoint of follicular lymphomas, I think an important piece of information was a study that I presented to you, the RESORT trial, because I think for many patients, there has been a big suggestion that maintenance rituximab, once you've had rituximab or chemotherapy plus rituximab, that maintenance rituximab, continuing the rituximab on an ongoing basis, is important to keep you in remission longer. And I think the RESORT study at least suggested that that may not necessarily be the case. It doesn't mean you can't do or shouldn't do maintenance rituximab, but I think it suggests that a patient who chooses not to do maintenance rituximab can do well in certain situations by foregoing that for a period of time and then reinstituting the rituximab later at some point in the future when it's needed. And so I think that's important, not so much because we're seeing advances in how people are doing, but I think it tells patients that they're in certain situations there can be flexibility about their treatment, and I think that's a good thing for patients, because some patients prefer one thing or the other based on their individual situation and their issues, whether it be quality of life or convenience. convenience or however they feel about their treatment. And so giving them options and knowing that option A or B do comparably in the long term, and so the patient can decide what works for them, I think is a good thing.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers today. Been extraordinary speakers, just wonderful. I know that, and I also want to thank all of you who've asked such great questions on the call. Really, they really enhanced the call today, and all of you who've been listening. And in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I do want to remind all of you that although the program, the workshop, will soon end, the services that you can access from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, those continue endlessly for you. And that's a very important thing for you to take away, because we don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that you're alone. We don't want you to feel that you have to deal with all of this on your own. And I just want to say a word about cancer care. We have a staff of 45 master's-level oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services from practical and financial assistance to counseling and support to support groups on the telephone and online. And we have these workshops and, of course, booklets and fact sheets. And as I was listening to many of your questions, of course, there's always the question of wanting to get some support around dealing with uncertainty. And a lot of our social workers are very helpful in dealing with those questions about, so how do I maintain the momentum of my life and in the midst of a successful treatment, but just worrying about the future. So we very much want you to know that you can have support from cancer care in those areas. Also, this is a time of year when people often feel, it's a time of holiday time, people can sometimes feel a bit more stressed out. I guess everyone does, but it also with coping with lymphoma, that can be a time, or cancer, that can be a time of stress as well. Be aware that there's support for you. It's accessible both from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. So again, I want to give you the phone numbers for both organizations. In case you didn't get to ask your question, please call us. The Lymphoma Research Foundation's number is 1-800-500-9976, and Cancer Care's toll-free number is 1-800-813-HOPE. Again, you're not alone. You're part of a community of support. Please take advantage of these services, and I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.